On this week's 51%, we speak with NPR's Marielle Segarra about her battle with early-stage breast cancer and what women should know going into their regular screenings.
Mammograms are not a perfect tool, and they're often unreliable if you have dense breast tissue, which half of the population does.
We also speak with a community doctor about why it's becoming more difficult for small-town practices to survive. I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jesse King. Our main guest today is the host of NPR's advice program, Life Kit, which helps listeners on everything from their relationships to their finances and mental health. Working in public radio, a lot of the job is telling difficult stories about other people's lives and the challenges that they're able to overcome. But for host Marielle Segarra, a recent episode of Life Kit got pretty personal. About a year ago, Segarra was diagnosed with early-stage breast cancer. Now, the American Cancer Society says about 1 in 8 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer in their lifetimes, but Segarra is in her mid-30s, and a lot of doctors still say women don't have to start screening for breast cancer until around age 40. The Breast Cancer Research Foundation says the number of women being diagnosed before age 50 is on the rise. Luckily, screening and treatment is becoming more advanced, too. Importantly, I should note that Segarra says she's doing well today. She recently spoke with WAMC News Director Ian Pickus to reflect on the past year.
So I went from basically an annual visit to my gynecologist, and being under 40, I'm not getting regular, or I wasn't getting annual mammograms yet. And so she just did a breast exam, which I would recommend that everyone do when they go to their doctor. But she felt a lump, and I had not felt it myself, so I was totally surprised even at that. And then when she said, okay, I want you to have imaging done, I thought, well, that's going to be fine, though. You know, I just really couldn't imagine that I would get breast cancer at this age because I don't have a strong family history of it. And I later was tested for genetic mutations, and I didn't have those either. It just wasn't really on my mind. So then when I had to go through the various stages of getting diagnosed, you know, doing a mammogram, an ultrasound, and then doing a biopsy, and then waiting for the results. And by the time I got the biopsy, I already knew that basically when they look at your images, they give it a score, like 1 to 5. It's called the BI-RADS system. And mine at that point had been given a 5. Which means highly suspicious for cancer, 95% likely. So I had some time to make peace with it, I guess. But the biopsy was basically done to confirm it. And I guess I thought, well, maybe I'm in the 5%, you know? But I wasn't. And I got the result the day after Thanksgiving. It was the radiologist who had performed the biopsy who called me. And I was really, really upset. And I didn't know what was going to happen next, because it was a Friday after Thanksgiving at like 5 p.m. And I just had to sit with that all weekend.
The ultimate Friday news dump.
Yeah, it was horrible. I mean, that kept happening throughout treatment. And other patients that I've talked to, this happens to them too, where your results get released into a patient portal often on a Friday after a radiologist looks at them, but no doctor has called you to tell you about them. So you get a ping in your email inbox that says, you have new results, and you have to decide if you want to look at them or not. You may not even have a doctor assigned to you yet, like an oncologist, for instance, a surgeon, and your gynecologist won't have seen those results yet either. So it messes with your head.
I identified with something you said about all of this, which is, you know, once you take the test, you might as well just breathe deep and wait for the result, because working yourself, you know, into a lather isn't going to help things either.
No, the results will be what they are, right? Either way, whether you panic now or not. So, I mean, it might seem easier said than done, but I found a way to do that throughout treatment. Because there, it's not just, if you do get diagnosed with cancer, it's not just that one result that you're waiting for. They have to find out how extensive it is and what type it is and what the treatment's going to look like. So there were many moments like that where I had to wait for results, and that they could really make a big difference in my life. They could make a difference even if I was going to be able to live. And when faced with that, I really went back to a lot of the mindfulness stuff that I've learned at Life Kit and just in my life in general. I just found that it doesn't make sense to borrow trouble from the future. I forget who said that quote initially, but I always think about that. It's let me deal with what I know today.
So you were young, as you say, for this type of diagnosis, and age is a moving target with respect to breast cancer and when certain tests should be ordered or not. What's the latest thinking for when people should start to really take this seriously?
Yeah, so more young women are getting diagnosed with breast cancer. We had to, when we wrote this piece, we did so much research, and there are like 100 footnotes in this episode, right? Because it's a very technical thing to talk about. But let me look at the exact stats. It's that in the past decade, there's been an increase in breast cancer diagnosis rates for all women, but even more so for women under 50. And we used to think about breast cancer as something that affected women mostly older than 50. But now, like, for instance, I interviewed a medical oncologist at MD Anderson Cancer Center, and he said that more than half of his patients are under 50. And their researchers are still trying to figure out exactly why this is. It's hard to pinpoint just one thing, which can be maddening if you are diagnosed, because then you're saying, well, how do I prevent this from happening in the future? You know, what lifestyle changes, for instance, should I be making? And we only know certain things about that. But I would say that anyone with breast tissue should think about their risk for getting breast cancer. And I say anyone with breast tissue because it could be if you're a transgender woman, it could be if you're a transgender man and you haven't had top surgery, it could be if you're a cisgender man, and even if you just have like pecs, that's still breast tissue. And if you, for instance, have a genetic mutation that runs in your family, you could get breast cancer. So there are all these factors that are involved. Also, what hormones you're being exposed to, if you've ever taken synthetic hormones. So I think it can really help to start with one of those online risk calculators and start with a conversation with your doctor and think about what factors are involved for you and what time it makes sense to start getting mammograms, if you should get mammograms. In most cases, so there's disagreement among the groups that issue these medical guidelines as to when women should get mammograms, when they should start, and how often they should do them. But the oncologists that we interviewed said they tend to agree with the guideline that is women 40 and older should get a mammogram every year. That said, mammograms are not a perfect tool, and they're often unreliable if you have dense breast tissue, which half of the population does. So that's another thing to really take note of when you get a mammogram is, does it say that you have dense breast tissue in the report? Because if it does, then you'll have to consider other kinds of screening and talk to your doctor about that.
You know, one thing I don't think I'd really thought through that much until I listened to this episode was that a lot of the treatment that you get, even if you are a patient who's dealing with a breast cancer diagnosis, comes down to your ability to self-advocate and to press. Whereas you just assume, you know, something bad like this happens and you're going to be in the best possible hands going forward and someone will know the way through. That's not always the case.
No, it's not. You can get really different care depending on where you go. And I've also realized that after getting multiple opinions for different parts of my treatment, that different doctors have different plans. And they look at the same numbers and statistics and studies and come to different conclusions. And so that might change, for instance, like if you are diagnosed with cancer, what type of chemotherapy you do and how many rounds of it. Or it might mean that you do a different type of radiation therapy. for instance, I got something called proton therapy, which is supposed to do a better job at saving surrounding tissue from and preventing it from basically preventing the rays from hitting the surrounding tissue. But that wasn't offered to me from the beginning. I had to have a friend who found out about it and found out that my cancer hospital actually offered it. And I had to ask about it. And then they said, oh, yeah, you might qualify. And I ended up getting it. But I couldn't believe that it came down to that, because it was the difference between whether any of the radiation would reach my heart tissue or not. And because if you have left-sided breast cancer, that's something you have to think about, right? Like if the radiation is going to potentially damage any part of your heart. And there are ways to position a patient and do breathing techniques to mitigate that. But when I did this other type of therapy, in my experience, and I will say we haven't at Life Kit reported on proton therapy or radiation, so this is all me speaking from my personal experience, but that was something that I just wish had been presented to me as an option so I could decide. But yeah, I had to advocate for it.
One thing I really appreciated about the episode and the way that, you know, the kind of research project that it set off is laid out is how it demystifies the language around discussing breast health and breast cancer. So who did you see as the audience for this project?
I saw... well, especially women, because women are more likely to get breast cancer. 1 in 8 women in a lifetime. Those are the current statistics. But particularly young women and women under 50 who may have started getting mammograms or may not have, and who may not be getting annual or any routine breast exams from a doctor. I really wanted them to know that they should be doing those things. They should be learning about what their personal risk is and trying to catch this if they are going to get it as early as possible, because it really makes a difference in how much treatment you have to do and whether this is going to be something that you have to deal with for the rest of your life or whether it's something that could potentially be cured and like stamped out completely.
So now that you have a little bit of distance here, how did all of this, how did this experience change your outlook, if at all?
My outlook on life?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a big question. I feel that I'm more resilient than I ever realized. And I'm also getting less ruffled by minor inconveniences. Like even things that I might have made me nervous or that I was scared of before. Like I was driving with my mom actually in Brooklyn, and she was trying to parallel park and someone was honking, laying on the horn behind her, and you know, the person ended up kind of scaring her away. And my mom's really good at parallel parking. She grew up in Brooklyn, but she was just like, oh, this person's being so annoying. And like, she didn't, but I was just like, you know what? Take your time. Like this person can wait. It's not that like you can wait, man. You know, like that, I just kind of felt like, okay. So I think when people, and when I see other people also making a big deal out of nothing lately, I'm just sort of like, yeah, miss me with that, you know. I'm kind of just like, I've been through enough this year, let's not make a mountain out of a molehill kind of thing, you know.
That was NPR Life Kit host Mariel Segarra speaking with WAMC's Ian Pickus. We'll have a link to listen to Life Kit's episode on breast cancer screening and awareness on our website, wamcpodcast.org. A heads up to listeners that our next story discusses domestic violence. Here in New York, Governor Kathy Hochul recently signed legislation expanding protections for family members of domestic violence survivors.
Bill is signed. Woo!
Melanie's Law closes a loophole in state law that previously prevented adult family and household members from obtaining their own orders of protection against a loved one's abusive partner. Before signing the law at the Family Partnership Center in Poughkeepsie, a Democrat said the subject of domestic violence is personal to her. Hochul's mother advocated for survivors throughout her life.
And I'm going to continue being this fighter, not just because of what I saw and the stories I had to hear, but for all those I feel responsible to protect, because my number one job as governor of the state of New York is to protect our citizens.
Melanie's Law is named after Melanie Chianese, a Wappingers Falls woman who was stabbed to death by her mother's ex-boyfriend, Paul Senecal, in 2022. Chianese and her son both lived with her mother, Cheryl Chianese Cavalli. Cheryl was able to obtain an order of protection against her ex, and that restraining order extended to Melanie's son, but not Melanie, because she was an adult. The new law allows all family and household members to obtain orders of protection in these cases, regardless of their age. Chianese Cavalli says her daughter would have turned 32 on Sunday.
Melanie loved to help others. That was her dream in life and her goal. She wanted to be a certified drug and alcohol counselor. And if given the chance, she would have been a great one. Right? And now today, she will forever be known as Melanie's Law. Thank you. God bless everyone.
In the years since Melanie's death, Chianese Cavalli has steadily advocated for Melanie's Law. It was first sponsored by Republican Dutchess County Executive Sue Serino back when she was state senator for the 41st District. It was then picked up by State Senator Michelle Hinchey and 43rd District Assemblyman Brian Cunningham, both Democrats. The bill passed unanimously in the state Senate and cleared the assembly earlier this year. Hinchey says she considers working on Melanie's Law to be a standout moment of her career.
Understanding the scale of this problem and this challenge, and something that we have the power to change by closing a loophole, we have a power to make sure that other people don't have to be sitting in this position. And they'll know for decades to come that this family and that we collectively in this community were able to stand together to make a huge change.
Family Services, which operates the Family Partnership Center, offers counseling and case management to survivors of domestic abuse. CEO Leah Feldman says it's common for abusers to target a survivor's loved ones once they lose access to the survivor themselves, and it's a big reason why survivors refuse to leave or report the abuse. She looks forward to helping family members as they, too, seek restraining orders in court, and she has a couple ideas about what the state could do next to support survivors.
It's a long process to get an order of protection through the family court system, which can also be a deterrent to individuals utilizing that system. So finding a way to speed that process up could be useful.
Feldman says it's important to watch out for signs of domestic abuse early on in relationships. She says abusers often start by isolating their partners, controlling their finances, and manipulating their emotions.
One of the myths is that is the black eyes, right? That oftentimes domestic violence is not physical until the very end, and sometimes until it's too late. So we like to advise people to look for those other red flags.
Paul Senecal was convicted of first-degree murder for the killing of Melanie Chianese and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole in 2023. Family Services has a 24/7 hotline for survivors of domestic violence at 845-485-5550. The National Domestic Violence Hotline is also available 24/7 by calling 1-800-799-SAFE or by texting START to 88788. Our last guest today has dedicated her career to treating chronic pain as a local community doctor. Dr. Niraj Sharma is a double board certified physician with her own practice called Cardinal Spine and Pain Medicine in Wappingers Falls, New York. She was voted the top doc in pain management by Hudson Valley Magazine for 5 straight years from 2017 to 2023. And she says a big part of that is because she is a local community doctor. Dr. Sharma doesn't work for a large hospital. She tends to her patients, many of them friends and neighbors herself, and takes the time to sit down and talk through their symptoms. I recently spoke with Dr. Sharma about some non-invasive treatments for chronic pain and why it's becoming harder for small town practices to survive.
I've been in Dutchess County for, I'm going to say, at least 16, 17 years now. Initially, I was with a larger group, and about 12 years ago, I took the leap and I started my own practice. And here I am, still standing 12 years later, thank you to the, you know, support of the community. So I'm very grateful. My focus is interventional spine and pain management. So it could include anything from headaches to a herniated disc. I see a lot of Medicare patients here. So, you know, older adults, and many of them have low back pain or neck pain. And for the majority of patients, I would say it's just symptoms getting progressively worse over time, not related to a specific trauma or injury. But then I also see patients that have had a workers' comp injury or something happened after a car accident. So I would evaluate those patients as well. But I would say most common would be something like, say, spinal stenosis, which is really a form of arthritis, which all of us get. We don't all necessarily show symptoms, but if we have those type of symptoms, I would see those patients in my practice on a daily basis.
So what are some of the common treatments or methods that you use in your practice?
Sure. The options that I usually discuss with patients are conservative treatments such as, you know, physical therapy, chiropractics, acupuncture, massage. And for those sort of treatment options, I do refer them to other providers in the area. We also offer non-narcotic oral medications from various categories, you know, things like anti-inflammatories. There are prescription strength anti-inflammatories. There are prescription topicals that may help. We also use nerve pain medications that may help with symptoms. We may use antidepressants that also have an indication to treat pain. And then the cortisone injections are definitely offered as well, because with those, we are directly delivering medication at the site of the problem. The step after me is usually surgical intervention, which is very rare for me to refer a patient to surgery if they have failed to respond to any of the, you know, or I should say all of the non-surgical treatment options, and they're still symptomatic. Say they can't walk, they have involvement of bowel or bladder where they're unable to control those functions. If they're requiring narcotics on a daily basis or any severe neurological abnormalities, then I would definitely reach out to our fellow surgeons in the area for consultation.
This might sound like a little bit of a silly question, but, you know, how do you know when the pain is bad enough to come to you? Because I think there's this perception, you know, I've heard my friends sometimes say, oh, I know I'm getting older because, you know, my back hurts, or I must have slept on the wrong side of the bed last night. But is that normal? Like, at what point does pain require an intervention beyond, like, Advil?
Right. I think that's an excellent question. And I think the way to answer it is, this is exactly why I examine my patients every single time, whether they're here for an initial consult or for a follow-up, because 99% of my treatment plan is based on physical exam findings, objective findings. So, you know, again, there have been many instances where I do an exam and I say, you know what, I think this is just muscle spasm. So I don't think you need injections. I don't think you need heavy duty medications, you know, just give it some time. Or, hey, let's try some physical therapy for a bit, focus on the muscular component, develop a home exercise program for you. And that may help. So you're right. Not all presentations of pain require injections or medications or any interventions at all. Sometimes time is all they need.
It's important to know that distinction, though, because pain can have a huge impact on how you live your day-to-day life.
Absolutely. Pain affects quality of life. You know, the motto for my practice here is let life take flight. So, and my practice is called Cardinal Spine. So it kind of ties into the bird metaphor, you know, when you have no pain, you feel light as a bird, and then let life take flight. So, you know, everything I do here is tied to improving someone's quality of life. I would say about 70% of, you know, the arthritis and the conditions we develop are genetic. So we're going to get them no matter what. And about 30% is environmental. So, you know, have you had trauma to your back? Were you in a car accident? Did you have a physically demanding job, such as, say, a nurse or a construction worker, truck driver? All those things contribute. Do you smoke? You know, there's so many variables involved. But, you know, again, we treat the full person here. We do a good exam. And I always order imaging prior to any interventional procedure. So I'm specifically referring to an MRI because it gives us a beautiful picture of the anatomic detail, which I go over the patient, you explain the anatomy to them. Patients want to understand where are the symptoms coming from. You know, you want to make sense of things. Going over that information is very helpful. And then it also helps shape exactly what procedures I'm going to perform for them.
So you've had your practice for 12 years. What has it been like running your own practice as an independent provider?
Sure. So I'm going to say it's been very challenging. It's very satisfying at the end of the day, but it's also very challenging because as a smaller independent practice, it's harder to negotiate contracts with insurance companies. We see a lot of Medicare patients here, and unfortunately for the actually, it'll be 5 years in January if the next proposed cut to the physician fee schedule goes through. We don't get cost of living increases as Medicare providers. Hospitals do every year, skilled nursing facilities do, but physicians do not get cost of living increases. In fact, we've been getting cuts every year. And if we take inflation into account, physicians have seen almost a, I think, 29% cut in their reimbursement since 2001, which essentially means that we're seeing less reimbursement now than we did when we were doing our medical school and our training. So, you know, it's becoming unsustainable. I know many colleagues of mine that have retired early or shut down their practices because it's very hard to maintain the financial viability of a practice. So what it does, it limits patient choices, and that's not right. They should be able to go to who they want to go to. And for example, small practices in rural areas or underserved communities, you know, most of the time, you know, they're only small practices like mine that are providing care. So that would have a huge devastating impact on these patients. Where will they go? You know, so I know there is a proposal in the House right now, bipartisan, shockingly, where they're asking for a reimbursement tied into inflationary changes every year, which would make sense.
Well, Dr. Sharma, thanks so much for taking the time. Briefly before we go, you know, what is something that you people commonly misunderstand about pain?
There is a misconception out there that in some way you are a weaker person if you seek treatment for pain. You know, a lot of times growing up, we're told, hey, just suck it up. You know, you'll be fine. You know, put some dirt on it or what have you. But it's okay to find out, you know, what's going on, what's the source of your pain, and how can we correct it? And, you know, sometimes just activity modification may be helpful. For example, you don't want to clean your entire house the same day. You know, I tell patients as we age, we want to modify our activities. So instead of doing the full home, do one room at a time. If you like to walk, instead of walking for a mile, walk for 10, 15 minutes, take a break for 5 minutes, and then carry on. You know, so as we age, we just need to modify. We should be able to still do what we love to do, right? Because that's our life. If we're not enjoying our hobbies, you know, that can lead to other things like depression and sadness and anxiety. So all this is tied in to the psychological component as well.
That was Dr. Niraj Sharma, a board-certified physician specializing in spine medicine in New York's Hudson Valley. Her practice is called Cardinal Spine and Pain Medicine. You can learn more about her work at cardinal-spine.com. Thanks to you for listening to this week's 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half, he was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. The nightmare down the hallway, I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool. Sweet bells in little girl dreams. They said, oh, I want a big life, not a house that could have been like. Where are you taking me? Where are you taking me? They said,